and welcome to That's What She Said, the fortnightly feminist podcast where we discuss current affairs, a badass woman from history, and your listener stories of the inspirational women in your lives. With me, Nina Ratridge.
And me, Hannah Thacker.
Hi, Hannah Thacker.
Hello, Nina.
I'm Nina Ratridge. How are you doing?
As some may be able to tell from the sound of my voice, I'm a little bit ill.
Yeah, it's a bit.
But the party must go on.
The party?
The podcast Ooh. Must go on.
Okay, we're doing a party podcast today. Party people!
Is that not... Wait, no, what's the saying? The show must go on.
I know, yeah. I didn't know you were doing that on purpose. Like, today's party is going to be about...
It was a complete accident. I must...
Golly gosh. Ay caramba. I think I sound a bit blocked up as well.
Well,
it's winter.
It is winter. I probably will.
Anything new?
Yeah. Over the weekend, I went to London.
You did, didn't you? Yeah. I meant to ask why and what.
See some friends.
Yeah, I thought it was.
A bit of a reunion with people. My friends that I went to uni with.
That's nice.
It was very nice. And we do a Secret Santa every year.
And yeah.
I got the best Secret Santa.
That's so
ever.
Good I saw this. It's just such podcast fodder. I love it.
I know. Well, which I have here, which is a book from my friend Izzy. She works in publishing, so she's all over the books.
Yeah.
And it's Life Lessons from Remarkable Women, Tales of Triumph, Failure, and Learning to Love Yourself. And it's done in collaboration with Stylist magazine.
I love it.
And Penguin.
It's so good. Penguin's so on it. They've got a little feminist section now, haven't they?
Yeah.
That's so dope. Tweet.
And then another one of my friends, who wasn't my Secret Santa, but she said, I just saw this and thought of you, so I got an extra present.
No way!
Which is great.
That's so good. I've had that before. I love it when people see something and think of you.
So I'm just showing Nina a lovely necklace from my friend Jenny. And she said, it's because of podcasting and music. And it's a little microphone and a little record.
That's so cute. I love it.
Isn't it?
That's really cute. That's a good present.
It is a good present.
The last time someone said they saw something and thought of me and therefore bought it me, it was the same thing. We did a Secret Santa with our friends at uni, and my housemate, my really good friend Matt, just said he'd seen something and thought of me, so he'd got me an extra present even though he didn't have me.
Yeah.
And so we at our Christmas dinner that we did at uni, he gave it to me. This was like 2-3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And he'd been going on about it for months. Like, he'd bought it months earlier.
Right.
Because he saw it and thought of me. So when it came to it, we were all like, what the fuck is this going to be? Because he's like, this has reminded me of you for ages. And I was like, okay. I opened it. It was just a glass. It was a glass from Tesco's that was purple.
Wait, what?
I know. Like a glass for drinking water out of or whatever.
What?
I know. It was very sweet
Picking
and lovely.
Picking it up.
I know. I was so confused. I was like, wait, what about this? Well, reminds you of me.
She's just giving it to you. Not I know. Wait till Christmas.
Yeah. Bless him. It was really sweet. Aww. I was a bit confused, though.
Purple glass.
Mm. It was like a nice ombre. Like,
yeah.
It was a nice glass. I've still got it.
Good.
I just don't know what part of it reminded him of me.
I don't know. Ombre.
It might have been my hair. Yeah. I think I might have had hair like that at some point.
Saw it on the shelf and was like, oh, that's a jazzy glass.
Yeah.
Nina would love it.
People always point at something really ugly and go, I can see you in that. Yeah, thanks.
If
it's a bright colour, they're like, oh, that's very you. I'm like, no, it's just a bright colour. I don't actually want to look stupid. It just happens sometimes.
Oh my gosh. Is there anything else going on?
No. Really boring. I've been writing an essay. Just been...
Reading a mountain of books.
Mm. I'm losing it. The book I'm doing my essay on is basically gay porn. And I love it. I'm obsessed with it.
This sounds like an excellent master.
I know. It's like so much bumhole stuff.
Oh, God. I found half the title for the podcast.
So much bumhole stuff. I got it in there early for you. There you go.
Thanks.
There you go. There's my daily funny TikTok.
Do you want your present? You can open it when we're recording.
Hannah, I didn't get you anything.
Stop.
Oh, Hannah.
It's fine.
Am I going to cry?
Probably not.
But you got me a present and that makes me want to cry anyway.
I'll take a picture of you with the present. Before and after.
It's so well wrapped. I'm so excited.
I'm very good at rapping. Aww. It's my secret skill.
There was me messaging Hannah last night, like, how do I spell your mum's name? Okay, I'm opening. I had to check on Facebook.
Bit of ASMR.
Yeah. You're so cute, Hannah. Hannah! She's done my research for me for the podcast for the next however long.
I give
long.
You the gift of research.
Yeah! It's a book called Forgotten Women, The Leaders. That, it's got a really nice texture, that front cover. Have you felt that?
Oh, yeah.
It's really satisfying. Mm. That's what I'm going to take away from this. Wait, so it's a series... I'll read you the blurb.
Okay.
Forgotten Women is a brand new series which will uncover the lost histories of women who over thousands of years have refused to accept the hand they were dealt and change the course of our futures forever.
Yeah.
Oh, Hannah.
I'm going to borrow it when you're done. Just to add to your mountain of books also.
I know, I love having... We're saying that, I think we must have said this on the podcast before, but when we move in together, we are going to have the best feminist bookshelf.
Absolutely.
And I'm so excited. Mm-hmm. I've got so many, I know exactly which one's going to pick out so you can read them. I'm really excited. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to hug you, but I'll do it later. So I'll just touch your hand. There you go.
Oh, you have really soft hands.
Thanks.
I am very sweaty.
clammy.
I was like, please don't touch me.
She looked at me like I don't know.
I was worried for your own safety, to be honest. Alright, enough larking about.
Enough funnying about. Let's crack onto the real shit, alright?
Yes.
Okay. So, it's Hannah's week to do the baddest woman from history, so this means I start with current affairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Sounds good.
Okay, so I've tried to balance it this week. I sort of ordered it positive, negative, or the other way around. So I'm going to start with, because... I don't know, our stories can be so depressing.
Mm-hmm. They can be.
But I've got a bit of both. I'm going to start, in fact, I don't know, they're not terrible. Okay, well I'm going to start anyway. So do you remember last time I was talking about the Moroccan Me Too movement, hashtag Mazaktash, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got some more Me Too stuff for you.
Okay.
I read an article, I've been trying to... expand the sources, the websites and stuff that I get my research from.
Yeah.
And I found some cool websites this time, which I'm going to have to share with you for research. But then we'll end up with all the same stories, so maybe not. I'll keep them for myself.
Yeah, you probably should.
Okay, so this is from a website called Burnt Roti, and it's an article that I couldn't really find who it was by, and it was driving me a little bit insane. The only information, it's kind of like a blog-style site, so it just said by Sakshi G. And I don't know who that is. Whoever Sakshi G is, please tell me, because it's stressing me out and I want to give you due credit. But anyway.
Okay.
So this is an article that was about how accessible the Me Too movement is for all women. Is it a movement that only benefits and is only really for privileged women?
Mm.
Which I think makes sense. So I didn't realise that in 2017, a woman called Raya Sarkar and other DBA, which is Dalit Bhujan Advisa, I don't really know what that is, I should have checked that, but a group of women in India released the Losha, which is a list of sexual harassment accused. It was basically a Me Too before Me Too, but not called that.
So it's like the penis list in Dietland.
Maybe.
So this book,
yeah,
which is great, Dietland. Mm. I have it up on my shelf. Another one for our feminist bookshelf by Sarai Walters.
Okay.
It's like a big like militant feminist group, and they release a book of like 100 men who have like done like
only 100
sexual assault. Well, they're the worst ones, and they say if anyone like sleeps with them, there'll be consequences.
Whoa.
It's very, very intense.
Crazy.
And they like, yeah.
I don't know about, I don't think it's that kind of list, but it's a similar kind of list.
Well, they're like guys who have committed sexual assault.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, their methods were criticised. They got no support for this, really. Their list was deemed inauthentic. It just didn't get any of the same press or praise as Me Too did, when it kind of was essentially the same thing, just calling men out on... It, like totally unacceptable behaviour. So obviously the Me Too was, like, it was a good thing. It was necessary. It was cathartic. It was revolutionary. The question is this accessible? Has this helped anyone other than, like, middle-class women in the spotlight? Not in terms of who it's helped, but in terms of who it's given a voice to.
Mm.
And also you've got the issue of language. So it's a very Anglophone, English,
yeah,
movement.
Anglified?
Yeah. It was all very English. It was very Western.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't speak English or you don't have a platform, is this a movement for you? That's basically what this article is raising in better words than I'd put it in.
Okay.
There's an example. So the woman that's written the article uses an example of a woman that worked in her house. So this woman was 22. She was mother to a four-year-old girl. And she told the writer about how she had an abusive husband. He spent all the money she earned on cheap alcohol. If she refused to give him the money, he would beat her up. This meant that her daughter couldn't attend school, and she was raped if she didn't want to be kicked out of her own house. And so the writer just basically says, how is this... How does Me Too include her story?
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't, I think it's fair to say. Ultimately, it's not about undermining the work that Me Too has done, because obviously it's raised an awareness of something that I think these things always start from the top and work their way, like, and trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to acknowledge that this is always going to be biased towards upper class, better known, wealthier women.
I'll definitely agree with you there. Is like, Me Too is very much, it seems, a Hollywood movement.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, celebrities who are already in the limelight and they say Me Too, and they cause a huge ripple effect, and it's amazing.
Mm.
It's to be thoroughly commended.
Yeah.
But for the everyday woman,
yeah,
you know, the, you know, woman living at home in an abusive relationship,
mm, it doesn't, it feels,
does
kind
it
of
benefit,
like,
her at all?
No, I feel like Me Too, just, it is one of these things where it's, because it's kind of marketable, it fits into a kind of box where
it isn't your hashtag.
Yeah, exactly. If it, like, I don't think anything particularly nuanced does ever fit into a hashtag. We need to think bigger. I think that's always the answer, to be honest. But you can't herald something as amazing and bringing about enormous change if it's not going to include everyone.
Okay.
And yes, we can praise Me Too for what it's done, but it does just feel kind of neat and Western, and
It's very easy to be like, well, we did Me Too, tick that box.
Exactly, yeah.
We're over that now.
Mm.
Really, Me Too is a starting point.
Mm.
And from that, we need legislation.
Yeah.
We need an evaluation of human rights.
Yeah.
There needs to be so much more work done, and I don't know where it would really go from there, but it's not satisfactory.
No.
For us all to say that Me Too was enough.
No.
Absolutely agree, and I think, I'm not sure how we can bridge the other languages together in order to make it a more unified movement.
Mm.
I'm not really sure about that.
I don't know. It starts with human rights, doesn't it?
Mm.
I think if we want to make it global, there's no point in trying to apply something about workplace harassment to women that don't work in such a kind of workplace, or don't speak the language, or where their main issue is domestic abuse, not workplace abuse. Yeah, it's globally recognising that women's rights need to be considered more human rights.
Yeah, I think the great thing about Me Too, as we saw in Morocco, is that it has raised awareness, and it has meant that other movements can have the platform to spring up, and, you know, and then women in their home countries, their home cities, wherever, in their communities, can see what someone else has done. Maybe it's a celebrity they admire even.
Exactly, yeah.
And use that empowerment to make a change for themselves and for people around them.
Yeah. I think the a central part of this was that in the wake of Me Too, there was new workplace harassment prevention measures taken up by the US government, which included setting up an email address for by the National Commission of Women to receive complaints and circulating lists with job openings in case women felt they needed to leave their old jobs. These are all great steps, but again, steps that aren't taking into account women that don't work in sort of organised sectors, women that do more casual work or in construction or are primarily homekeepers.
Yeah.
And also the central fact that the original list was just ignored. The list that I mentioned at the start, that theirs was criticised. It was like, this is inauthentic and sort of not tasteful to release this list.
Right, because abusing women is so tasteful.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so irritating.
Yeah, they were shamed for it. And obviously some women were shamed for joining in the Me Too movement, which is, again, another problem with it, because the women at the top were heralded as brave and everything, which they entirely were. But a lot of women trying to do it on a smaller scale within their own lives were, like, ridiculed. Movements are great, but I don't think you can have a movement for everyone.
I think one thing that's always crept up in all of our episodes so far is movements in different countries. We've had Morocco, we've had Ireland, we've had Saudi Arabia. They're all for serving different purposes and for different kinds of women. But for me, that's really hopeful.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And despite all of the shit that still goes on and how depressing it can be, there are these like glimpses of hope.
Yeah. I love hearing stories. Well, obviously that's why we do it, but
just to cheer ourselves up, really.
I do just love hearing these stories that go beyond what you might see in the normal press that we read every day.
Yeah, on the 7 o'clock news.
Yeah.
That was a stab in the dark. I'm like, when
is their news?
When do they show news?
What is news?
Does Trevor McDonald still do it? I'm pretty sure he does.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I've not seen him in a while.
But I think my mum saw him on a beach once.
Oh,
I don't know.
I somehow can't imagine him wearing anything but a suit.
It's weird, isn't it?
A beach suit.
She saw some news reader. Maybe, I don't think it was Trevor. No, I'm thinking of something madder.
Okay,
that was a good story.
That was a good story. Thanks. Until you ruined it.
I'll just make it up. I've seen all news readers in swimwear. Go to my website.
No, you're not Perez Hilton. Okay.
Excuse me.
Do you have something happier?
Yeah, do you want something happier?
Oh, I have something happier. This year's Miss Universe competition was held on the 16th of December in Bangkok, Thailand, where the first transgender contestant took part. Her name is Angela Ponce, and she represented Spain.
Yes.
It is pretty awesome. I think it's been since 2012. That they've allowed transgender contestants to take part.
Okay.
But this is the first contestant to reach the final stages. Okay. And I have a lovely quote from her. She's so eloquent. She had so many great quotes. But this is the one I picked out. My hope is for tomorrow to be able to live in a world of equality for everyone. Simply for us all to understand that we are human and we must make all of our lives easier. If I can give that to the world, I don't need to win Miss Universe. I only need to be here. Awesome.
Huzzah. Bravo.
That is the most middle class response.
I didn't know what to say. I was going to say big up, but I did that
you
so
did
much
say,
last time.
You need a new
I need a new race. One. I don't think it can be huzzah, can it? I trot in on my pony. Okay.
A point about Miss Universe, I don't necessarily agree with beauty competitions. However, if they're going to happen, representation is key.
It's one of these things where no one likes everything in life, and not everything. Everything is problematic, but we can find ways to make it at least equal in its problematicness. Problem.
All right, so that was just a little...
That's nice.
A little news bit.
That's
very
nice.
Happy.
That's good. I enjoy that. Wait, so when's the final, do you know?
That was it.
That was the final.
On the 16th of December. Okay. And Miss Philippines won.
Cool.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Miss Philippines. Have you seen Dumpling on Netflix?
Yes.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I did love it. Mm-hmm. I liked the drag community's involvement. I know I wasn't expecting it. And I was like, do you know what? It makes fucking sense that drag and beauty competitions.
Yeah, it was very heartwarming. Mm. If anyone hasn't seen the Netflix film, is it a Netflix film?
Yeah.
Dumpling. It's really good. It's
Dumpling.
Dumpling. I have to posh everything up. Yeah, it's basically a daughter of a former beauty queen,
aka Jennifer Aniston, off of Friends fame.
Her daughter isn't like typically what you'd expect for a beauty contestant,
mm-hmm.
and she really doesn't like that whole world, but she decides to do protest against it by entering the competition and ends up loving it with the help of some fabulous drag queens and her friends, her newfound friends, and it's just like so heartwarming.
It's so good. I love it.
It is very
sweet.
It
did wrap up a bit too neatly for me.
A little bit, but I mean,
when very pro, by the end it was very pro beauty contest.
Yeah, it was.
And I was like, that's kind of undermined the whole.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was it was a nice message, but I feel like she, I don't know, they didn't have to, I don't know what I wanted. I'm just a bloody cynic and I want everything to be negative.
I was definitely watching it with a hangover and I was like, I'm just happy
ending. I'm so happy.
Yeah.
That's why when that's I watched, all I needed. To All the Boys I've Loved Before or whatever it is.
Is it good?
It's what you'd expect it to be.
Okay.
And there's a beautiful man in it, which I enjoy.
Okay.
There's a smile in my voice. I could hear.
That's enough of a recommendation for me.
I could feel the, you can hear the smile in my voice as I was like, a beautiful man. Oops.
So shallow.
Oh no. Well, anyway.
Anyway, back to you.
Back to me. So what do you think people don't like feminists talking about, like men?
What?
Okay.
What do you think they don't like feminists talking about, like men?
What do people expect feminists to talk about? Or what do people always think female comedians talk about?
Men hating?
No.
Periods?
Periods. I want to talk about periods.
Okay.
Because we can't be a feminist podcast and not, even if it's just to piss people off. But this is good. This is good. So this is from The Pool in an article by Elle Turner. There was an event organised by Project Period to discuss the issue of period poverty. So there were different organisations in attendance, which I'll talk about in a minute, called The Cup Effect, Free Periods, Orna, Betty and Bloody Good Periods, which are all centred around putting an end to the lack of access to menstrual products and awareness around periods. So just a few lovely statistics for you, which you've probably read somewhere before, but I've never really dwelled on them because it is pretty mad and it makes me a bit angry. So did you know that the average lifetime cost of having a period is £4,800?
Fuck that.
That's, I could buy a pony with that. I'm so posh today. Something about being in the morning makes me posh. So this means that in the UK, more than 137,700 girls have missed school after being unable to afford sanitary products. 40% said they've used toilet roll in place of a sanitary product. And also there's the issue that we don't have a clue what goes into them, like tampons and pads, etc. There's no laws about stating what goes in them, which is a bit weird.
Yeah, I've seen this coming up a bit more recently about, you know, products that don't use chemicals and they use only natural fibres and stuff, because, and I'd never really considered it before.
No, it's weird, isn't it? You don't think about it.
No, you do not.
You're just going to fucking shove some up there, sort it out. Like, I'm not thinking about what it is.
Definitely not.
So this article interviewed some of the women involved in the event and involved in the organisation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these women. So first up, we've got Mandy Reed, founder of The Cup Effect. I'm pretty sure you'll have heard of menstrual cups by now. They're pretty hot.
What are you doing?
I don't know. What am I doing?
Silly voices.
I don't know. So The Cup Effect is a charitable NGO and social enterprise focused on raising the profile of menstrual cups and making them more widely available. So I had a look, a little look-see at this because I think this is really good. So for every cup purchased through the organisation, 2 are donated worldwide to women that can't access them.
That's awesome.
And
yeah.
It's all not-for-profit, so all of their profits mm-hmm. go to donating.
Mm-hmm. And menstrual cups aren't one use.
Exactly. So I'll talk about that. So they're reusable and each one can be used for up to 10 years.
Wow.
And that means a decade of dignified periods for a woman that would like them.
A decade of saving money. It's like a grand.
Yeah.
Nice.
I know. So apparently, this is Mandy Reed speaking now. So menstrual cups have been around since the 1930s. Didn't fucking know that. She said, but I only discovered them in my late 20s, and I consider myself to be a fortunate, well-informed person. So, having them having made such a difference to her life, she's well-informed and was able to access and know about them. She started thinking, imagine the repercussions if we could make more people know about them,
mm-hmm.
and it convinced them to try them, because a lot of people are kind of squeamish about them. She also speaks about the need to banish sort of inherited assumptions about groups of women, because I think a lot of people just say they're not for me.
What do you mean?
To use a menstrual cup.
Oh, okay.
Because you've got to kind of learn how to use it, and I've never tried, to be honest, and that's on me. Basically, it comes with assumptions that people won't be willing to try them. So she spoke about how she went to visit a community of Muslim women in Lamu in Kenya, and before she went, she was warned they will never go for it, they'll never use it. But when she got there and educated everyone about them, it just wasn't true, and they all now use them.
I do think it's a lack of education and a confusion about, how do you use them? Don't they make a big mess?
Mm.
Are they really impractical? Them being changed in a public loo, I think, is a big scare for people. But they're now being modified to be a lot easier for that.
Yeah.
And I remember we had some Always Lady coming in.
Always Lady?
Yeah.
Like the brand.
Okay. Coming into my school to do a talk about sanitary products.
Mm.
And that was pretty much just focused on sanitary pads.
Yeah.
It must have been about 14, 15 when she came.
Okay.
That was pretty much the extent of our sex ed as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was all we had, and it was like, well, obviously you're gonna use what the Always Lady said.
I was still obsessed with the Always Lady.
There was no menstrual cup lady.
Yeah,
menstrual cups weren't a thing when we were at school.
They weren't. I mean, they're having a big moment. I was trying to say before, mm-hmm. when I just said big. No, I said hot, didn't I? They're hot.
Yeah, they're hot right now on trend.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I remember my secondary school, maybe year 8 biology teacher telling us about them, just randomly. Yeah.
Good on her.
Yeah, and we were all just so freaked out because she just whipped one out of a drawer. And I think it was the one she used, and we were all like, that's
so weird. She's trying to do her part.
Yeah, I know.
I appreciate that.
I approve of her now, but at the time I was like,
ew. Yeah, right, do not appreciate
that's
that.
That's being a fanny. You look so unimpressed at me this morning. This is what I'm like in the morning.
I'm not a morning person.
No, I'm not either.
You're like a ray of sunshine this morning.
Aww, that's nice.
I'm like a gremlin.
I've been up long. Well, I've been up longer, and also I had to drive, so I've been awake.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, anyway, more from periods, off of periods. Gabby Edlin, founder of the Bloody Good Period, which is an organisation that provides free menstrual products to refugees and asylum seekers at centres in London and Leeds. So she says, I remember when I first started, I was told to hide the products under the table and hand them out one by one. But I said no, how will the women know what they want? So she started laying them out for everyone to see so they can browse and choose what they need. Her aim is to expand the organisation so it can reach as many people who need free sanitary products as possible. Because everyone has a right to a bloody good period.
True that.
Nice message. Mm-hmm. I've got a few more, so I'll go straight on. There's Amika George, founder of Free Periods. At the age of 17, she was so shocked by a report about period poverty in the UK that she started a petition
mm-hmm.
asking the government to provide free sanitary products to all girls who receive free school meals. I've heard of this, and I think this is brilliant.
Yeah, I've heard of this as well.
So that was in 2017, and since then, the petition has gone on to gather almost 200,000 signatures. She helped kickstart the social media movement, hashtag free periods, along with fellow campaigners Scarlett Curtis and Grace Campbell, organised a protest march in Parliament Square that was attended by hundreds. And she's now at Cambridge and is running the website Free Periods and takes part in events across the country spreading the message of period poverty.
That's an impressive teenager.
She's an impressive young lady.
She's probably still a teenager, right?
She was 17 in 2017. Oh, that's such a useful age. She never has to think about it.
Not at all. So yeah, she's 18. Or 19.
She's a baby.
I know. Very,
she's so good.
Very cool.
Impressed. Well done, Amika George. There's also Leah Renfrey Peplow, co-founder of Orna. This is a bit confusing, right? So Orna is a German word meaning without, and this article said it's pronounced Orna.
Mm-hmm.
But then in an interview with The Woman, Leah Renfrey Peplow says, we pronounce it on.
Oh.
I don't know which it is. So it's either Orna or on. But in the words of Renfrey Peplow, they pronounce it Ron as a nod to when you're on your period.
Okay.
But I guess that it's probably just a combination of Orna and on. I think it's Orna.
Is it like a fun twist on words?
It's a German word.
Like when people replace like E with the letter 3.
No.
Said in all seriousness.
I don't think so. I think it's just what it means.
Yeah, like when people do like spellings that aren't reflective of the word you say, but you still get what they're saying.
Okay. Maybe.
Maybe, or maybe I'm just thinking about it too much.
I don't know. But I think basically they put pronounced Orna because that's trying to make it easy for us English people to say. I think it's probably somewhere between Orna and on. I think it's like Orna.
Oh,
Orna. Orna. I should have asked my mum. She speaks German. Okay. So Orna's aim is to tackle the injustice faced by those without access to menstrual products and without the access to information about what they're using. This is the one that's talking about the regulations about what goes in them. They draw the parallel. There's more regulation around pet food than there is about disclosing and disclosing what goes into them and what goes into them themselves with tampons and etc. Many mainstream tampons are made from rayon and bleached polyester, which contains toxins, and also you've got the plastic packaging, the applicators.
Mm.
Bad for the environment.
Yeah, there is a lot of waste.
Yeah, I know.
It does kill me.
I know, it's really frustrating, but also you're gonna
I ordered some of those period pants.
Did you?
Yeah, from Thinks.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that they come all the way from America, so it's a bloody ages to get here. And then I wasn't in, so they went to the post depot. Apparently the post depot only keeps it for like 12 days.
Oh, no.
And then it's gone again. So no. I went and it had been shipped back to America.
No.
And now I'm like too tragically scarred to order some more.
That's
I'm like,
so annoying.
Will this happen again?
Yeah.
But no, I need to find a UK base.
Yeah, get a UK.
So if anyone knows of any UK base period pants producers, it's a
periods
lot.
Producers.
A lot of peas. Like, let us know, because we'll definitely give them a shout out, and I genuinely want to buy some.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I've found a few new brands that I'm interested in now.
Okay.
From this, like the menstrual cup one that does the two. I think I should try that. I think it's time for me to try a menstrual cup.
Okay.
I say this now. I'm committing. So Orna's tampons are made out of, they produce tampons, and they're made out of non-toxic, natural and sustainable ingredients, 100% organic cotton and paper packaging. They also provide schoolgirls in Zambia with health and menstrual education, so they know what's happening when they get their first period. Why did I say it like that? When they get to their first period. They've also equipped schools with new hygienic toilet blocks and the tools, equipment and instructions needed to make reusable sanitary pads to make a long-term sustainable difference.
Awesome.
Big up.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally on this topic, we've got Betty, which is a service that provides free PSHE association accredited online and in-school resources that teaches... That was such a weird sentence! I was like, when's it going to end? So Betty for Schools provides free PSHE education. No. Betty for Schools provides free... Okay. It's me not being able to use punctuation. Right.
Cool.
Betty for Schools provides free PSHE association accredited online and in-school resources.
I'm glad we got there.
Yeah. That teachers and parents can use to educate school students aged 8 to 12 about periods. The lessons encourage open and honest conversations about periods and the way it affects girls, used by teachers to educate teens about menstrual health in PSHE lessons and to destigmatise the conversation about periods from an early age. They also go into schools themselves and girl guiding groups up and down the UK on their Betty bus, providing a safe space for boys and girls to explore the emotional side of periods. They've also created a teen-facing online platform, Betty.me, which is a hub of everything they need to know about puberty, pads and periods. This year alone, Betty has given away over 50,000 pads to disadvantaged pupils.
What is it? What?
50,000.
Numbers are not our strong suit, no, but really, if you, this is your first time listening.
Numbers.
Plus. Learn this now.
Okay. Fucking hell. Well, that's that.
50,000.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's a massive number.
Yeah. And they're going to be pushing period education to the forefront of the curriculum in 2019.
It bloody needs to be.
Yeah. Bloody good period needs to
bloody
be.
Bloody good education. Bloody good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Please.
There we go. That.
So another clumsy segue, I guess.
Clumsy? They've never been clumsy. Oh. They've been accidental and nice. No, there's never been a nice segue. Go on. Just talk.
I will just talk. That's what we're here for. I decided to go down a psychological route. I was kind of led down there by a few different articles, and that there is psychological evidence to show that mental attitudes towards gender are changing.
Yes, motherfucker.
Which is very cool and exciting. So this was a study in Psychology Today led by Dr. Barbara Reisman. To note, this is an American study, so obviously, this is more based on American mindsets and psychology.
That's cool. I can go with that. Do an American accent.
Never.
Okay, fine.
No, I think that, for starters, I have a cold, so it's even worse. And I think, the only American accents any British person can do is, bad Texan.
Yeah, that's true. Do you want to try?
Cowboy.
Do you want to try a bit of bad Texan? Just one sentence. Just the headline.
I don't know how to start.
Just try. Please. I'll pay you.
Right, so do you ever have this with accents where you have a trigger word?
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
I don't have a trigger word for an American accent. So with a Bristolian accent, it's water.
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 Yeah.
Water, my lover. And then with Newcastle, it's always it's pooper scooper. Roller coaster.
Oh my god. Okay, I don't know what's happening there.
All the accents.
Away.
I think that's my two accents also.
Then we must be able to muster up an American between us. That's so weird.
All I keep thinking of saying is yeehaw.
Yeehaw!
Yeah.
Random cowboy. Ooh, that was American. That was American.
That was very good.
It was very good. Thank you. Mental attitudes. Oh my god.
Should we
just ignore it?
Shall we abandon this part?
Maybe. Okay.
And I'll crack on with this very
do what
serious
we're actually good at.
Psychological study.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, a study in Psychology Today, which was led by Dr. Barbara Reisman, analysed responses from the General Social Survey from 1977 to 2016. This is actually a new article, even though it's slightly old research.
Yeah,
it's two
years,
but not super old.
This is how academia works, slowly.
Yes. There was over 27,000 respondents in all, so good survey. And the team set out to examine exactly how gender attitudes have changed, hoping to discover, and I quote, whether each generation is more liberal or if younger people yearn for the less harried past.
Okay.
From reading it, they were saying, are millennials as liberal and equal as we assume they are, or is it the fact that millennials are so tired of trying so hard that they are now reverting to gender roles?
Okay.
And there are a small group of young people who are doing that, who are, women are becoming homemakers and having children, and men are going out and bring home the bagels, as Peter wants us to say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Little memory reference. Well done. Thanks. Which, yeah, I think is an interesting idea in itself. There's some really good statistics. So in 1977, less than a quarter of the US population believed men and women should be equal.
Wow.
Yeah.
1977?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. Rapid changes.
Yeah.
That's what they were saying as well in the article, is that in recent times, progression has slowed, whereas, you know, during, I suppose you would say second wave feminism, it was, like, massively, like, jumping.
Mm.
However, contrast this to 2016, these views were virtually non-existent. Only 7% of the population believed women were not equal to men.
Okay, good.
And you can imagine that some of those people from 1977 were still alive.
That's true. That is likely, I would say.
Yeah, so it could be an old generation, it could be some more conservative youth.
Or it could be that they think women are better than men.
True. Also, we never consider this, I think. So they concluded that millennials were the most egalitarian demographic. Demographic?
Was that democratic or demographic? Oh, that's a good one. A democratic demographic. A demographic. I like that. Look at you making words.
I did make a word. Millennials were the most egalitarian demographic, with more than 75% believing that men and women should be equal in work and home.
Okay.
More than 75. I expected it to be higher.
Yeah,
but
I would have done, but okay.
The argument that progress has... Oh, I wrote this bit. I'm like, oh, not a copy and paste. So there's an argument that progress has slowed, but mental attitudes are much better, although it would be nice if that gender pay gap buggered off.
It would be.
That's my words. Okay. My words.
It can bugger off. I agree.
Yeah. So I thought that was a little bit too tidy.
Yeah.
So I decided to do some more research.
Okay.
And I found evidence that gender bias is still a very real problem, just in case anyone was uncertain.
Just in case anyone felt positive for a minute there. Don't.
Yeah.
Get back down. Sit down.
And this again is American, which I think is quite handy when we're using original American statistics to bring another American study in.
Yeah.
So according to a study carried out by scientists from New York University and the University of Illinois, girls and women are likely to be regarded as intellectually inferior to their male peers, regardless of whether their cognitive capabilities are superior or not.
I did an interesting slash depressing essay for my undergrad about the gap between boys and girls in education. And there's a phenomenon called gender quake in schools, which, if I'm going to remember this correctly, I've just totally dropped myself in it by saying this, but it's the notion that while boys are still kind of considered naturally smarter, girls do better in schools. And instead of looking to why boys are doing worse, it's becoming like blaming the girls for doing well.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre. Instead of being like, well done girls for doing well, it's like, no, it's your fault that boys are doing bad. And there's this belief that school environments are more catered to girls than they are to boys, which there may be some truth to, but that doesn't make it girls' fault.
The education system was built by men
for men. Exactly, yeah.
Girls were not allowed to have an education.
Yeah.
In the Victorian era, for example.
Exactly.
It's only been since the turn of the last century that women have had access to education.
Yeah.
And even then it's been difficult. I think the fact that women are discouraged from doing other activities such as sport means that they have more time to do homework.
And also there's the girls in schools feel like they have to work harder. You've got more to prove. It's really depressing but interesting to research. And there's actually, I've read stuff before about the way we, this is a bit of a tangent, but the way we treat children when they're literally newborns, about the difference between bouncing a baby girl on your lap and whatever else you do to a boy. I can't remember, but it's very like...
throw a boy across the room.
rugby tackle it, shake his hand. Pat it on the head.
Oh, well, I have definitely seen this. Obviously, I've got a little sister who's five. So I was seeing that whole world. And, you know, the argument was like, oh, well, boys are just so much more confident. Just like, I'll let them go and do that really dangerous thing over there. And girls are much more like sheltered. That's not for everyone, and that's not in every community. That is like my personal experience. Yeah. But yeah.
I've actually started to think about it because I don't know any other children really apart from your sister. Mm-hmm. And it made me start to think about the way I, because the reading that I do and the way I live my life, I think about these things a lot. Mm-hmm. And it did make me think about the way I talked to her. And I was like, I wonder if I've ever like said she looks pretty or, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I think it's got to be a balance. Mm. Of course you can tell a little girl she looks pretty.
But not instead of her being...
But, you know, as well, say, oh, you're also really funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You're also really smart.
Mm.
Or start with that, and then, I don't know.
Yeah.
You got to be
like
conscious.
I like to commend her outfit choices.
Because they are brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's made these decisions, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so returning to the study, which was published in American Psychologist,
mm-hmm.
I have a quote from the associate professor from the Department of Psychology at NYU, who co-authored the study. She's called Andre
3000.
Sipian. Yes. Sipian, I'm going to go with.
Okay.
She said, despite their achievements in the classroom and the workplace, our experiments suggest that women and girls may still encounter bias and circumstances where brilliance is viewed as the key to success. And the leader of the study, Lynn Bayan, who is a doctor student at the University of Illinois, explains that these prejudices may stem from preconceived notions of gender that have been taught in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So just what we were saying. They concluded that a woman has a 25.3% lower probability of being referred for a job that mentioned intellect in its description. And then going back to Andre 3000... Our studies add to our current understanding of the process that lead to women's underrepresentation in genius fields, that is, fields such as physics and philosophy, in which success is generally seen as depending on high-level intellectual ability. Moreover, while gender bias may be becoming less common in employers' and supervisors' public behaviour, such as hiring or promotion decisions, in part because the possibility of bias is often explicitly discussed in these contexts, young women's path to a successful career goes through many contexts in which people may be less guarded and or evidence suggests may still behave in biased ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, as well as it being American, it's also very binary.
Yeah.
So just a couple of little side notes there. But yeah, it's interesting that they're saying although gender biases are lessened,
mm-hmm.
once you get into the job,
yeah,
getting into it in the first place mm-hmm. is the real struggle now.
Yeah, and I've listened to, like, I heard statistics before about the percentage of women that will apply for, like most men would apply for a job that they didn't feel qualified
mm-hmm.
for.
Yeah,
but women are much less likely unless they feel like 100% qualified because
mm-hmm.
it's effort. Like, I think if you think you're less likely to get it as well, like, you don't want to go to the effort of, like, the emotional labour of putting yourself through it. Like, it's difficult.
Yeah, I've seen these statistics as well.
Mm.
You know, men are much more likely to go for that.
To just apply.
Yeah.
Mm.
And whereas we're... And also, men are much more likely to ask for a raise.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. That's a great quality to have.
Yeah.
I wish that was also encouraged in women as much as it is in men, because if we all did that,
I know
it would be much more equal playing field.
Yeah, it's just so difficult, much more to lose
anyway, but it's getting better.
Yeah, cool.
That's a lovely statistics show.
Thank you, statistics. I appreciate that.
Love it.
Okay, I'm gonna take you, it's a bleak situation with a bubble of positive that I'm gonna describe. So we're going to northern Syria.
Okay,
this is a story about the village of Jinwar in northern Syria, which has been described as a feminist utopia. So, amidst the war zone, the ongoing conflict in Syria, a group of women have created an escape from the chaos around them. It's been built over the past 2 years, and it's a self-sustaining hamlet, an ecological...
Words!
An ecological idyll.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Idyll.
Whatever that is. It's a little paradise.
Idyllic place.
Yeah. A little ecological haven. I can't say that word, where women rule and men cannot stay. This article interviews some of the young women that live there and older women. This is a quote from Zainab Gavari, a 28-year-old resident of the village. There's no need for men here. Our lives are good. This place is just for women who want to stand on their feet. So it's a women-only commune a few miles from Kamishli, a city in the mainly Kurdish region of northeast Syria. It was set up by local women's groups and international volunteers to create a space for women to live free of the constraints of the oppressive power structures of patriarchy and capitalism. Talk about two birds, one stone, patriarchy and capitalism. Like, fuck it all.
Well, they're all tied in together.
Yeah. So the homes were built by the women. It's all self-sustainable. The women cultivate plots for to feed their own families. So murals and statues of women at work are scattered around the site, in the centre of which is a garden of meadow flowers. And it's described as in complete contrast to the surrounding villages. So just a few years ago, this entire area lived under the ISIS caliphate. So in response to the brutality that came with that, that's to say thousands of Yazidis were massacred, thousands of women were kidnapped by the group to be made sex slaves. So in response to this, this village was set up where many Kurdish women took up arms to fight the extremist group. The founders of Jinwa see their project as a continuation of the women's revolution that led these same women to leave their families and go to war. The image of these Kurdish women tends to be women fighting on the front line, but the Kurdish society is still very conservative. So this is why they set up Jinwa, a place for women to escape family-oriented roles that a patriarchal society had assigned to them. So Gavari, who we spoke to before, spoke about... Mm-hmm. She married when she was young, but her husband died not long after they were married. So she's got a child. She said that her mother begged her not to come and live in this commune, but she still came. She brought up her son alone for 10 years and suffered a lot. Without women, there is no freedom, she says, which is a mantra written on the walls in Jinwa. Until women educate and empower themselves, there won't be freedom. So the message here, clearly very political. They're arguing for a greater role for women in society, but also the premise of the place is ecological and communal living as an alternative to modern life. So they spend the bulk of their time ensuring that their practices are self-sustainable. So a lot of the time is feeding and looking after themselves. It's cooking and
growing food, like, and maintaining the commune.
So 17-year-old Nisreen Kadar moved to the commune with her sister, and she does... They are aware of the fact that this is kind of isolated and could be quite boring. So Nisreen Kadar says, our life alone is sometimes boring, but at least it's a life of self-reliance and it's the life of free women. I don't think this is a future, an ideal future, but they're making the best of a dangerous and horrible situation.
Absolutely. What is the alternative?
Exactly. It's amazing what they've done. I went on their website as well, which is a bit difficult to navigate. They need someone to do
that. I mean, they're living in a self-sustaining commune. Web development isn't the priority.
So they talk about how social demolition and war and crime hurts women and children the most. They therefore believe that it's their most sacred duty to continue to construct Jinwa. Some women victims of war urgently need these spaces to heal and recover. Other women who have alternative imaginations of free women's spaces can join this work to achieve the life they desire in Jinwa. Young girls and women will take part in the development of the community.
Cool.
Using the wise methods of our mothers, who are a part of history, Jinwa women will plant and harvest crops. They will raise the animals and make yogurt and cheese from their milk.
Awesome. Can I have some cheese? I want yogurt or cheese. Maybe some babes.
I'm not going to have any because it makes me difficult to speak. And I don't think I need any.
I just love... This is, like, completely irrelevant. The name Jinwa.
Yeah.
It sounds really cool.
I think it means something. But I didn't look that up.
No.
But anyway, women supporting women.
That is really cool.
Guy that went to Jinwa was talking about how the the gates, like, are defended by a young woman with a giant gun on her shoulder, which just, it, I mean, I don't know, I hate war zones and stuff, mm-hmm. but they're so capable.
Yeah.
They're protecting themselves.
That's great.
I'm not sure what the political situation exactly in that area is anymore, but I don't think it's one that ISIS are present in mm-hmm. anymore.
I love that, without women, there is no freedom.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to get that tattooed or something.
What we were talking about a few episodes ago as well, about women being integral to peace processes, because they get excluded from them politically so often, but having women in international politics more is proven to be a way to negotiate more peaceful futures, which makes fucking sense, because if you're negotiating peace for 50% of the population,
exactly.
You're not, are you?
You can't have representation. Yeah. That's what it comes down to. Mm. I hope Jim will do well.
Me too.
Keep bringing in women that
I hope someone
needs...
works on the website.
Yeah.
That is not really what I'm taking away from it. I'm only jesting.
I know you are. also, right, so speaking of formidable, world-changing women,
mm-hmm.
as the community of Jinwa are, well, it's like the end of the year now. We're not going to be back until the new year. And my new fave, Mag Stylist, put an article together called 10 Inspiring Women Who Changed the World.
Yes.
So I'll read this little intro from the team at Stylist. Women in history shouldn't be a mystery.
Oh, look at that.
That was the Stylist motto for 2018. A year in which we pledged to help raise the profile of women now and from throughout history. Our goal was to commemorate the centenary of women first winning the right to vote by celebrating the work of the suffragists and the suffragettes. But as we started researching, we got thinking about all the women whose work we should know more about.
Yes.
I've got more stats for you. Apparently I'm very into the stats today.
Just making it hard for yourself.
Uh-huh. So women only make up 32% of the MPs in the UK Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at college, so back in, like, I don't know, 2011 or something, I remembered it was like 14-15%.
Yeah.
So it's already come a long way, yeah. but still not 50,
no.
still not representation. Only 32% of all speaking roles in Hollywood are held by women.
Aww.
So a lot of dudes. And just 24% of global news stories are about women. And a horrifying 2.7% of British statues are of women.
2.7%. Are you going to talk about statues? Or?
Later,
okay,
yes.
Well.
But that excludes royals and mythical women.
Yeah. Put up the mythical women instead of the real ones. Well done, Ariel.
It's like, here is statue of naked woman. Mm. She is Venus. And it's like, cool, thanks so much.
Yeah. Relatable.
Yeah. So I have all 10, if we want to go through them.
Yeah, you can do that.
Do you want to take it in turns, reading out the 10 women?
Yeah.
A little bit of fun.
Yeah.
So first up, they shone a light on Millicent Fawcett. She was known as the law-abiding suffragette.
Yeah.
she gave speeches, wrote essays, sat in Parliament, challenged MPs, and proved through her intellect that the rights of women were worth fighting for. So she was actually in Parliament when the vote for women was given.
Nice.
And she was married to an MP.
Yeah.
She herself tried to become an MP. And yeah, so she was like the more like tame version of the suffragette. She was like, we need to do this legally. We're going to get anywhere. So that's pretty awesome.
Okay. Well, I can add to this because I love her.
Uh-huh.
So this is next up. We've got Jameela Jamil, with her fight against impossible beauty standards with the Ai Wei movement.
Mm-hmm.
Also brilliant actress. And all-round fabulous feminist.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
I love her.
I love her
actor,
too.
Actor.
Yeah. and we've got our little Ai Wei stories
built
up on our Instagram.
Yeah, our highlights.
Mm-hmm. So next up we have the women of the Irish abortion vote. This was submitted by Anna Fielding, who says, "The Repeal the Eighth campaigners are all heroes, and every one of them is my woman of the year."
Aww.
Awesome.
Women of the year. Let's have all of them.
All of them.
Let's just have women the year. Yeah. Now we've got Jodie Whittaker, the first female Doctor Who in the show's 55-year history.
Yeah.
I love her. I really enjoy. I had an argument in a taxi with a man about this.
It was Did really fun. You? That's my favourite hobby.
I went to visit my friend at uni. No. my friend from uni,
mm-hmm.
at home,
mm-hmm.
and we got a taxi back with one of her work colleagues, and he started just talking. He was in the front and we were in the back, and he'd got like loads of takeaway. He got like a pizza and two kebabs or something, and we were in the back with like most of the food. This is a side story, but basically we ate pretty much his whole pizza.
He offered us
a slice.
Oh.
But he started pissing me off, so I just kept eating. But he just started talking about how rubbish the new Doctor Who was. And I got really pissed off. But I was in a really sassy mood. So I just let him go off on one for ages. And then afterwards went, Ruth, weren't we just saying about how she was our favourite Doctor Who? And Ruth was like, yeah, she's brilliant. She's just the best Doctor Who there's ever been. And then we started talking for ages and he got so uncomfortable. And Ruth has never watched it. She had no idea what I was talking about, really. But I think she's fucking brilliant. I genuinely mm-hmm. really do. But he was just basing it all on the fact she was a woman. And it really fucking pissed me off. So I just let him say it and then made him look really stupid.
Excellent.
And ate all his pizza. So I win.
Oh, that's how you get him. Eat that pizza. Next on the list, we have Ariana Grande. So she's had one hell of a year.
I know.
So the 25-year-old, also 25.
Is she 25?
She's 25. Same age as me. Okay. Look at her. Look at her.
Yeah, she's special.
She is a gifted child. Child? A woman?
Being.
Oh, God. So the 25-year-old was the most listened to female artist on Spotify, and the video for her latest single, Thank You Next, tune.
I'm just obsessed.
I am obsessed.
I love it.
It was the most watched YouTube video in 24 hours ever.
Whoa!
Yep.
Go.
Her net worth is an estimated £40 million.
Yeah, I could do some of that.
I mean, when numbers get that big, I lose contact.
After a million, I'm like, yeah, you're rich. I get it. To be honest, after less than that, got a grand in your bank account, I'm like, woohoo!
Oh, yes, millennial life. So considering all this, it has actually been a really tough year for Ariana Grande.
Yeah.
She was obviously involved in the terrorist tragedy at Manchester Arena.
Yeah.
Very close to home for us.
I know.
A heart-wrenching breakup and the drug-related death of former boyfriend Mac Miller, which was all drawn out in excruciating detail by the media.
Yeah, thanks for that, media.
And yet she's conducted herself with just an openness and a warmth and acted like a fucking human being.
Yeah, she's brilliant. I'm growing to love her quite a lot.
Me too. I love her.
I think she's great. She's a good old role model, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got now Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who you will have remembered in the news a lot for testifying sexual assault against the US Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Did mm-hmm. he get it?
Yeah.
He did, didn't he?
He did.
Because I remember the one that was, it was going to be if it wasn't him. What am I trying to say? The next
nominee?
The other nominee.
Yeah.
Was, we talked about this, didn't we? You told me about this. I'm just repeating what you've said to me. Aren't I? No.
I can't remember.
Well, the other nominee was a really extreme...
They were both bad choices.
Yeah. It was grim, yeah.
Yeah. Well, who else was Donald Trump going to nominate?
I know. Brilliant.
Mm.
Huzzah.
Moving on. He always has to have at least one mention in this bloody podcast. Irritating human being.
Yep.
All right, next up we have Nadia Murad. I think we've discussed her before on the podcast.
That feels familiar.
Another 25-year-old who's just smashing the patriarchy.
I've got 3 years, I'm going to be...
Still hope you.
Yeah.
Not me, decrepit old person that I am. So she's a human rights activist who won this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
Since 2014... The 25-year-old has travelled non-stop around the globe, meeting world leaders and journalists to share her story of being sold into sexual slavery by ISIS. Again, she's a Yazidi. After meeting human rights lawyer Amal Clooney in 2016, she was convinced to build a legal case against ISIS.
Yeah.
And together they began collecting evidence of the genocide against the Yazidis. So far... they have a ton of evidence, but very little progress.
Yeah.
But her raising awareness of this issue is exactly why she deserves the Nobel Peace Prize.
She's
and her bravery of talking about her enslavement is astounding. If you're not aware of Nadia Murad, go and look her up. She's truly inspiring.
Yeah, I think I need to know more about her. we have got now Sally Rooney, author of Normal People, who won Waterstone's Book of the Year award, and at 27 she's the youngest author to win the award.
Yeah.
When I read Normal People then, the reason I looked at you funny was because I thought you were saying she was a normal person.
And on the list we have a normal person.
I was like, what are the others, Hannah? I'm so confused.
Yeah, I just thought that was cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
I've not heard of the book or read it.
No, I haven't.
They're just the fact that she's the youngest author to win the award.
I know, well done.
Very good. All right, next and second to last, we have Emma Gonzalez, who is the survivor of a shooting and leader of a new gun control movement.
Yes.
So on 14th of February this year, a gunman got out of an Uber at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle. Gonzalez hid in the auditorium as 17 people were killed and another 17 were injured. It was the deadliest school shooting in US history. Horrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely vile. However, 3 days later, Gonzalez picked herself up somehow and called out the government on their BS for the lack of gun control, because they were just making excuses. They were like, oh, we're really sorry, but...
I know.
Sorry, but... about everything. It's just... So this pissed her off, quite rightly. She joined Twitter for the first time and in a day gained 1 million followers. That's got to be a record.
Yeah.
And she then set up a gun control advocacy group with some of her classmates and organised an event called March for Our Lives.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of people turned out on the 24th of March. So this is like just over a month after the shooting.
It's crazy.
And this was the biggest protest since the Vietnam War protest.
Whoa, didn't realise that. I remember it happening, but I didn't know that.
So she sparked huge change in her country. You know, she's convinced governments to change, like local governments to change their stances, and schools as well. And she's been awarded with the International Children's Peace Prize by Desmond Tutu, who said...
I love Desmond Tutu.
Yeah. He said, "I am in awe of these children whose powerful message is amplified by their youthful energy and an unshakable belief that children can, no, must improve their own futures."
Yes. Oh, just... it makes me so proud of, like, millennials and that get so much shit.
Oh, but
they're fucking doing everything.
Yes,
it's
they
just,
are.
Am I a millennial?
I think we're just...
I don't know what one it is.
We're on the cusp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm proud to be one then. I want to be lumped in with these guys.
I think we're slightly aged millennials now. But,
old millennials. Okay. But, no, I think if the biggest criticism is that they care a lot, then fuck off. We're brilliant.
All right, final, and I feel like this one's well suited to
it. It is. I was actually really happy when I saw that, because I was like, yeah. Okay, so Hannah Gadsby.
Mm-hmm.
She was the comedian behind the... it's a Netflix. Was it a Netflix original, or was it just recorded? Is it her stand-up?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, it's on Netflix anyway, and watch it. Behind Nanette.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the traditional comedy setup of self-depreciating jokes, and then she turns the finger of blame on the audience for being implicit in bigotry and homophobic humour. I think I might go a little bit further than that.
Okay,
I think
go.
I just... the thing that I took from that the most was that it is a big part of comedy. Self-depreciating comedy is a big part of humour, and pretty much all comedians do it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a belief that it's better to take the mick out of yourself than it is to other people, which there's something for that. But she talks about roasts, I think, as well for this, because a person that isn't a white middle-class man, if you're not part of a hegemonic structure, like she isn't, she's not a very feminine-presenting woman, she's gay, taking the mick out of these things in yourself just fuels the ability for other people to do it. It's putting the words into other people's mouths, and it, to some extent, makes it okay. And Nanette is just phenomenal. It's basically a stand-up show about how she's going to quit stand-up for this reason.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing. I think she's just fucking brilliant. It made me really happy. I watched it on a coach and cried.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So watch that.
It's not what you expect at
all. I know. I think she's fucking brilliant, and I'm really happy. Do you want a few more happies? I've got a couple of palette cleansers. So this is an article from the website Wussy, which I'm now obsessed with, by Evan Brechtel, about drag syndrome, which is a So it's called Drag Syndrome Collective, and it's performers with Down syndrome finding liberation through drag.
Wow.
I love it so much. It made me really happy. So it talks about how drag has always been a tool for liberation for queer people. It's a way of expressing gender and sexuality beyond convention. Mm-hmm. And basically, this collective is trying to sort of defy the conventional view of people with Down syndrome as like cute and sweet and angelic and very rarely sort of sexy and powerful. And this is giving people with Down syndrome the power to assert that through mm-hmm. drag, which drag is just brilliant for expressing yourself in any way as queer or other or taking fierceness back. And mm-hmm. I just love it so much. So it talks to one of the performers, Aurora Shebang. She's been with Drag Syndrome since the collective's first performance at Vogue Fabrics in Dalston. She said, it was a banging of a night. It was perfect for me as a performer. It was exciting. She says that since that, she's just as ambitious and fierce when just in the rest of life.
Mm.
She says, I'm a busy queen. Currently, I'm working on a film and other projects, so I got my bitches to bring me costumes. My inspiration for performances are coming from Aurora Shebang. She knows what she's doing. I just love it so fucking much. The shows are in super high demand now. They've just finished two sold out engagements in Oslo, with plans to tour Sweden and Dublin in the near future. I could talk about this forever, but that's the gist of it, really. They've all done loads of research into the history of drag to find out who they want their personas to be. A concluding remark in the article I'm going to read. Drag Syndrome is continuing the efforts that the mission of drag has been doing since its inception, to shatter expectations, defy perceptions, and make the world a fiercer place.
Mm.
I like the word fierce.
Yeah,
I think fierce is a really good word. I want to be fierce.
I think it's good to bring that bit of fierceness into Down syndrome community as well, yeah. Because like you say, there is a very common perception.
It's just eye-opening and changing perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Changing perceptions is one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
I like that.
What an awesome initiative.
I know,
like, so unexpected.
Yeah I just don't know how I stumbled across this, and I'm glad I did, because I never would have thought of that, and that's on me. But
I bloody love drag as well.
Yeah,
I'm really obsessed. I didn't tell you, I ended up in a drag bar in London.
Yeah.
But so we were like trying to find a karaoke bar in Soho, but surprise, surprise, last minute, they're all booked up.
Yeah.
And instead we went to this place called Salad Door, which is an underground former public loo. Teeny tiny.
Do you know the history of public toilets?
Huh?
Oh, sorry.
The history of public toilets.
Yeah, like underground public toilets.
Yeah.
And the gay community.
Yeah.
You know about it.
Not really.
Oh. Well, it's basically just that when homosexuality was illegal, you could be like kicked out of your apartment if you had like gay sex on the property and your landlord found out.
Right.
So loads of people had sex in public places.
Mm-hmm.
And public toilets were a big...
Oh, yeah. I knew about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I didn't realise it was underground public toilets.
Yeah, like the temple in Manchester.
Ah, yeah. There we go. Yeah. So it was and there was a drag artist being a DJ for the night. She was very funny. Yeah, and then a unexpected addition of the Duchess, who was a burlesque dancer.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, I'm not expecting this. So yeah. Accidentally saw my first burlesque dancer.
I've never seen one.
I was quite excited because it's like an art form.
Mm.
But this was like 2 minutes of not much art form.
Did you see some nipple?
Saw nipple tassels.
Oh.
Not nipples.
Okay.
But yeah.
That sounds fun.
It was
I want to see some burlesque.
I want to see a proper burlesque show.
Yeah, like a whole show.
Mm.
Maybe we can do that in the new year.
We should.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
I support that.
So, coming back up our way, on December 14th, the statue of Emily Pankhurst was unveiled.
Yeah.
In Manchester's St. Peter's Square.
My dad went.
Did he?
No, he didn't.
Oh. No, he didn't. Has he gone to see it or something?
He went to the one in Oldham.
Is that one of Emmeline Pankhurst in Oldham?
No, it's Annie Kenny.
I'm not.
Another suffragette.
Okay, that's cool.
I don't know the name. I'll check.
So the Emmeline Pankhurst statue is the first statue of a woman to be erected in Manchester since Queen Victoria was unveiled in 1901.
In Piccadilly Gardens?
Mm.
That was in 1901?
Mm.
Dope. I really like that statue. It's so powerful.
I mean, it's fine.
It's got a lot of pigeon poo.
I just feel like it's another royal person.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not excited about the royals, but I think it's a very impressive statue.
It's massive. Mm. It's probably the biggest statue of a person in Manchester.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I tried to do a quick summary of Emmeline Pankhurst.
Okay.
And her role in the suffragette movement, because as much as we can assume that everyone is aware of who she is and her actual role,
I probably don't know specifics.
There might be some people who really don't know other than her name and that she was a suffragette.
That's understandable.
So, here we go. Quick history time. She was born in 1858 in Manchester. She became a prominent member of the women's suffrage movement, setting up groups in London and Manchester before solidifying her efforts into the Women's Social and Political Union in 1903, more commonly known as the suffragists, who were fighting for women's rights, including the right to vote. For anyone who's familiar with the movement, you'll be aware of the various legal and political actions taken against the suffragists by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who's not, there's films and there's documentaries and there's loads of resources to go check out.
I love a good resource.
Yeah. But I suppose some points of interest. Activists were arrested, force-fed when they went on hunger strike, let out of prison in order to regain strength before being rearrested. This was known as the Cat and Mouse Act. Mm. Women in the movement reacted with militant tactics, which caused thousands of pounds of criminal damage to target insurance companies. They also took some members also took private jiu-jitsu lessons to protect other women, especially when the Cat and Mouse Act was deployed, and also to fight the police in hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And of course, women also died, most famously Emily Davison, who was struck by a horse at Epsom Races when she went there to protest with a banner on the race. She went onto the race course was killed by the king's horse.
It was, yeah.
A lot happened between now and then, including a war.
Yeah.
In which Emmeline Pankhurst said, like, let's call off this fight against government and work towards the war effort. However, in February 1918, 9 months before the end of World War I, the British Parliament passed the Representation of People Act, which granted men aged 21 and over the right to vote, regardless of whether they own property or not, in addition to granting the same right to women aged 30 and over, as long as they met certain property qualifications.
Yeah.
So if you were rich and over 30.
Lovely.
Having not giving up the fight, Pankhurst and her suffragettes kept pushing the government until 1928, when the Representation of the People Equal Franchise Act was passed, so that all women aged 21 and over were given the right to vote. And that same year, Emmeline Pankhurst passed away, aged 69. So I'm bringing up this brief history.
Mm-hmm.
I think she, at the time, was controversial, and looking back with hindsight, also controversial. You know, at the time, she was really hated by the government, especially Winston Churchill, who referred to her as that woman. And her acts of terrorism, because it really was terrible, like, they made bombs, they exploded buildings, they destroyed businesses.
Mm.
That has become bound up in her eponymous phrase, deeds, not words, which wasn't what that meant.
No.
It was, you know, let's actually see some political action rather than just talking about it.
Yeah.
And instead it became bound up with, let's burn this building down rather than talking about it. And in more recent times, she's been criticised for her racist, elitist and conservative views. So some people may be like, well, why do we have a statue of a known racist?
Mm.
And that's a good question, but also I think it's more about what the statue represents.
Yeah.
you know, it symbolises a movement, a mass unity of women, and the bravery, confidence and unflinching determination of those suffragettes to break down the patriarchy piece by piece. And that's what I'll think about every time I go past the statue.
I know, I'm really excited to see it. I've got a silly. Are you finished?
I am done.
Okay. I've got a silly to finish this section on.
Okay.
This is, I love children. It's really cute. So, this is what 6-year-olds would want if they could vote.
Okay.
So...
Tying it in nicely.
Yeah, extend the vote to 6-year-olds.
Accidental segue.
Okay, so these are just little quotes from some 6-year-olds. Emma would like, I think we should ban school uniform because it's too hot sometimes to wear it. True. Leah.
True.
I would like to change the parks to make them quieter, and there should be more parks for children to play in. And I think they should add more grass to the ground so when people fall down they don't get as hurt, and we'll get less grazes and it would be more fun to play on. Yahir, I think that they should make the week different and have 2 days at school and 5 days at home to see family more.
Aww.
Children are so very cute. Zainab, we should make books free for us to read. Yeah.
That is a very, yeah. Yes, very insightful future politician, yeah. There.
James, they should ban the television because it is bad for your eyes and instead of watching TV, we should play with our pets.
Yes, that was me.
I love it. Cara, this one's really something. They should ban alcoholic drinks because sometimes people get drunk and do bad stuff like stabbing and they also get hungover, which is like being ill. Stabbing and hangovers, like, put on the same level there, Cara.
Oh, gosh.
This one is my favourite. I don't know who's raising this child, but my God. Nor, the government should ban buggies in the school then because babies and nursery children should learn to walk.
Like, lazy babies.
Ban buggies. Ban buggies in the schools. What buggies are in schools? I enjoyed that. Anyway.
They should learn to walk.
Just learn to walk.
They do eventually.
How bless do you think him. You did it, Nor?
Bless him.
Okay. That's that then.
Oh, that's great.
I'm ready for
I
you.
I did that. Yes, badass woman from history time.
Is that the new jingle?
Yes. This is going to be good. I'm very excited.
I'm excited.
I was doing yoga a couple of days ago.
Well done.
Getting into my Warrior 2 feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm so happy. You're telling us right now, like the yoga instructor's like, you are a warrior. I was like, well, this ties in perfectly with my research. Thank you
Perfect.
For helping.
Yeah.
And because I absolutely love myself, I've given the task of pronouncing Mongolian names.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a reasonable thing to put on yourself.
I have like looked up a few different pronunciations and I apologize deeply if I muck it up.
Okay.
But I'm going with Kudlun, which is Mongolian for bright moon.
Oh.
So this is Princess Kudlun, known as the warrior princess, the wrestler princess, the princess of 10,000 horses, and she's also the great-great-granddaughter of Genghis Khan.
Okay. Princesses of 10,000 horses is what I used to want to be.
Me and my 10,000 horses come up in this. Oh, okay. I'm going to enjoy it. Nina's going to like this.
Horse girl.
We're going to go all the way back.
This might be our oldest one.
It is definitely our oldest one. To 1260.
Oh.
Very old.
I was not born then.
Not many people were. This was the year that Kudlun was born. And around this time, the Mongol Empire was starting to fracture. Rather than there being one united nation under a Khan, as in Genghis Khan's day, there were multiple rulers. The majority of these preferred the old nomadic ways seen as essential to Mongol identity, including Kudlun's father Kaidu. The princess's cousin Kublai Khan preferred politics, government, and lavish lifestyle.
The TV show.
Okay, we're going to come to the TV show.
Okay.
Hold your horses. Hey! Hold your 10,000 horses.
Wait, that's not very Peter.
I don't
hold
fuck...
your... I don't stroke fuck... your horses.
Why can't you hold your horses? I don't want to... Give your horses a hug. Hug your horses.
Hug your horses.
Oh my God.
Hug your 10,000 horses. There's so many layers to this. Go on.
Oh God. Okay, so these were kind of the two main people. Kaidu and Kublai.
Okay.
And they eventually just went to war against each other in a conflict that would last 30 years. A long-ass war. Oy. So back to Kudlun. She had 14 brothers.
Oh, no.
And she was the only girl.
Oh, no.
She was born into this traditional lifestyle. And her father gave her the same education as her brothers.
Okay.
The education was riding, hunting, fighting, using a bow and arrow, wrestling. And she was extremely competitive with her brothers.
Good.
She became an integral part of her father's army. And although it wasn't uncommon for women to take part in battle, you know, there were lots of women archers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of essential to survive out in the Mongolian steppes where there was wolves and stuff, you know.
Wolves and shit.
Yeah.
And horses.
So although it wasn't that uncommon for a woman to be in the army, it was unheard of that a woman would take a position of authority.
Okay.
It's important also to note, because of the age of this story and the fact that most of our knowledge about her comes from a Western perspective of Marco Polo,
okay,
who visited the Mongolian Empire, there is embellishments, there are westernizations.
Yeah.
But I've tried my best to like cross-reference my sources.
Nice.
From 1260.
Yeah, all those many, many sources.
Yeah. But Marco Polo is going to be a recurring source here.
Okay.
So I really love this quote about her in battle.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. Sometimes she would quit her father's side and make a dash at the host of the enemy and see some men thereout as deftly as a hawk pounces on a bird and carry him to her father. And this she did many a time.
Whoa.
So to translate further, it's basically she would lead the army with her father.
Yeah.
They'd be riding at the front and then suddenly she would bolt off on her horse towards the enemy, who would be like, what the fuck?
Oh my god.
This is terrifying.
Yeah.
And she would just grab one of the guys as a captive and take them back to her father. And she did this time and time again.
Fucking
and
hell.
It's like in multiple sources this is talked about.
It's a pretty cool technique, isn't it?
Yeah. And I also said before, you know, it's not that common for someone to be in a position of authority and to be like leading the army into battle. However, because she was so athletically skilled, the Mongolian people believed that she must have special powers from the gods.
A woman that could do things? Must be.
God. So who is going to argue with that?
No,
she's
got
superpowers.
I'd take that, yeah. Fine.
She's also the only woman in recorded history to be given a gerge. That's what I've got down, which is G-E-R-G-E-E, which is a medallion made out of precious metal typically given to men by the Great Khan to signify their status. There was a different kind of medallion for women.
Oh, but she got the
Got given the men's honour and was the only woman in recorded history to be given this medallion to basically say, you're the shit.
Do you think it said that?
You're the shit. Have a necklace.
You're the shit. That's a good title contender.
Cool. So, yeah, there's quite a lot to take in there already. My favourite thing about Kudlun is also the reason why she's called the Wrestle Princess is that she was brilliant at Mongolian wrestling.
Yes.
Which is brutal. There are no rules
in
Mongolian wrestling. It's just basically do whatever you have to do to get them on the ground.
Eek.
Yeah.
Start talking to them about existentialism. Reduce them to tears.
Crippling
mess on the floor.
Yes. I mean, her technique was less wordy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I respect that.
She was so good, in fact, she was undefeated as a wrestler. And when it came to the time that she was expected to take a husband, Kudlun was resistant to the idea because it meant that she would have to leave her military lifestyle, probably have to leave her community and go and be subservient
A
bloke.
Don't be subservient.
No. So she said, fine, I'll get married if he can beat me at wrestling.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. It's so Game of Thrones.
And also, if you lost your match against Kudlun, you have to give over a bunch of horses. And I'm saying a bunch of horses because
as currency.
Some sources say 10, some sources say 100.
There's a difference there.
There
I feel
is.
Like somebody misread Zero, mm-hmm. much like I do all the time. Five. So,
a lot of horses, yes. Yeah. And when Marco Polo met Cullen, it was in 1280, so when she was 20 years old.
Okay.
And he said she was very beautiful, but also so strong and brave that in all her father's realm, there was no man who could outdo her in feats of strength.
Shitting hell, huh?
Mm. And apparently, at the time he met her, he recorded that she had 10,000 horses. This is why she's princess of 10,000 horses.
I love the 10,000 horses.
Which is just ridiculous.
Like, and she had 10,000 horses. She's beautiful and strong. And have you seen her 10,000 horses?
Important note, 10,000 horses is at this time is basically shorthand for more than I can count.
Yeah.
Though it's probably unlikely she had 10,000
like
horses.
16.
It's more than
they're moving. I can't count
more
them.
More than he could count.
No, Marco, there's just two. It's the same one as before.
I think she had a lot.
Okay.
Apparently, her herd of horses, is that a herd?
Yeah.
Of horses.
Yeah.
Would rival any Khan. A lot of the male rulers.
Any of their herd of horses. I thought you meant, I'm sure, I was like, a herd of horses of any size could be a human, I'm fairly sure.
So, back to Marco Polo's story. One of his stories, because he wrote a lot about her. A highly suitable foreign prince arrived around this time.
What we've been waiting
to win the heart of Cullen in a battle. And he, because he was so ballsy, offered 1,000 horses.
Oh, God.
And according to sources in both Christian and Islam texts of the day...
According to sources or horses?
Sources.
According to the horses of the day.
You're really hung up on these horses.
I know, I'm sorry.
So according to varying sources...
Okay.
Not horses.
Okay.
In both Christian and Islam texts of the day, either Cullen's parents or the Caesar himself pleaded with her to throw the fight. He was basically the best contender they had.
Okay.
Like, he was a prince. He was rich as hell. And some sources say that she actually did agree to throw the fight.
Yeah.
But when it came down to it, her competitive nature got the better of her and she won.
She's like, fuck, I really wanted to marry you, but I just want to pin you down.
I can just imagine, though, like, this guy comes up like, I've got 1,000 horses. Mm. If you can have them if you want them, but you can also marry me. And she's just like, you're not going to win.
Yeah.
No. I'm definitely going to enjoy beating you.
Oh my God. That's so good. If anyone ever proposes to me, I'm just going to start fighting them and see what they do. It's like, if you win, you may have my hand.
It is cool.
Mm.
But I think if I put that bet down, I would definitely end up having to marry some other person. I probably wouldn't even be that strong. It'd be terrible.
I don't know how many marriage proposals I think I'm going to get in life, but apparently I'm going to fight for them. So.
Oh dear. So we're going to do a Cullen style.
Yes.
Yeah.
Our future spouses out there, take note. If we start fighting you, that's why.
So, around this time that she was having all of these wrestling matches, disputes between Kublai Khan, who was then the ruler of the Chinese Yuan dynasty, so he was Mongolian, but he'd like become part of China as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaidu, so Kudlun's father, disputes between them intensified and a war ensued that proved indecisive, so they had a battle and one won. Yeah.
Didn't know that. Never heard of that before.
Soon the Mongol Empire split into smaller kingdoms and they no longer had the immense power that Genghis Khan once wielded. After this particular war, Cullen did in fact get married.
Okay.
Although she remained an undefeated wrestler.
Ah.
It's uncertain who the lucky guy was.
I bet it was a woman.
I'm pretty sure it was at least a guy.
At least a guy. At least a man. Come on.
Some sources, again, going back to some sources, suggest that it was this dude called Aptakul.
A dude.
Who was hired by Kublai to assassinate Kaidu. However, once he was captured, He acted so valiantly as a prisoner.
How can you be a valiant prisoner?
I know. That Kaidu promoted him to become an elite soldier in his army.
Okay.
To me, this sounds really unlikely.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know much about the ins and outs of
Carnian. It's like, so she turns down a prince with 1,000 horses, but
come on,
marries,
1,000 horses
marries a former assassin, someone who tried to kill her dad, who she absolutely loves.
But there's no mention of the horses. He could have had 1,500.
I don't think he had any horses. And they didn't do a wrestling match.
Okay. Well, she's just got it all wrong then.
She chose him. Yeah. She chose a husband, essentially, okay, at the end of the day. Which is kind of like, even though she made the rules, she then broke them. And I love that.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. She's like, I want to do it this way. Change my mind.
Other sources suggest that it was Kaidu's companion from the Chorus clan. So basically one of her dad's mates.
Fair enough.
Or the, as the Islamist travel writer, so equivalent to Marco Polo, Rashid al-Din, wrote that Kudlun fell in love with Ghazan, a Mongol ruler in Persia.
Oh, okay.
And they ran off into the sunset together.
Did they?
Yes. But they don't really know.
Yeah, yeah.
All they know is that she got married. Some sources are very, like, romantic about it. Like, oh, she fell in love. Mm. Her heart was won at last. And others are like, well, there was really nasty rumours going around that because she was unmarried and spent so much time with her father, they must be having an incestuous relationship.
That's
so it suggested that she got married in order to stop the rumours.
Oh.
Which just, it's exactly what happens every time. As soon as there's a woman who goes against the grain, it's like, well, what's the thing we can say about her? Oh, I know, she's a witch. Or, I know, must be having incest.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, it always happens.
Yeah.
Towards the end of his life, her father, Kaidu, attempted to make way for Kudlun to succeed him as the Khan.
Okay.
However, the amount of backlash from the Mongolian people, who simply couldn't imagine a woman as ruler, meant that Kudlun decided to back one of her brothers instead.
Oh, that's a shame.
So although they had accepted her as, like, a god-blessed
fighter. Yeah, it's like, sorry, fighter, you can be a god but not rule us.
Yeah, she can be chosen by the gods, but she can't be that much. However, she did take the position of head of the military.
Oh,
which is pretty cool.
That's quite cool.
Yeah.
It says the pacifist.
And I also really love her. I know, different times.
Yeah, I know.
Very different times. It's 1280 or whatever. Oh, I also think it's really cool that her dad was wanting her to be Khan.
He was like, come on, guys. You met my daughter.
I mean, he had 14 sons, and then his youngest was his 15th and a girl, and it seemed and his favourite.
That's sick.
It's very interesting.
I enjoy that. Mm.
So then Kaidu died without being able to make his daughter Khan. And 5 years after Kaidu's death, Kudlun also died under unknown circumstances at the age of 46,
that's quite approximately. Young.
It's quite young, isn't it?
Yeah.
So some suggest that she died in battle.
Yeah.
Very likely.
That would be.
Or that she was assassinated. Also very likely.
Yeah.
Because she still technically had a claim to the leadership.
If 13 people died before her.
Hmm. Well, it wasn't, they didn't do it like that.
Oh, did they not do it linearly?
No.
Okay.
It was more like, who is the best for the job? Who is probably the strongest and the biggest as well? And she was bloody strong. So yeah, I think that's her life. So we'll go into a little bit following her death. She fell into obscurity for about 300 years.
no time at all.
Nope. And since her coming back into sort of public knowledge, she has been dramatised and fictionalised quite a lot.
She does seem quite well suited to that, I would say.
It's a good old yarn. any chance to use these words? In 1710, a Frenchman named François Petit de la Croix was putting together a biography of Genghis Khan and wrote a story based on Kudlun. This story was called Turnadot, which translates to Turkish daughter, but it greatly changed the facts of her life.
Oh.
This version, Turnadot, challenged her suitors with riddles instead of wrestling matches.
Shut up. That was a thing.
What?
Wrestling was a thing. Don't take that away from me.
I know. Obviously, it was impossible to imagine a woman wrestling. So instead, she's just Ridley.
Fuck Ridley. Oh, she's Trixie, that one.
I know, yeah. That's like so playing into the female stereotype of a trickster. And... Mm. Anywho. And if they failed her challenge, they were killed.
Instead of horses. Yep. You've forgotten about horses, Francois. I think you might have done. You don't know any horse girls, do you?
So intensely horsey.
I'm not even anymore, but it's just such a good way to feel like a child again.
Oh, God. Well, that's all I'm doing. That's all I'm trying to do. Just bring back that childlike magic.
The horse days.
Oh. Okay. In the early 1900s, the story of Turnadot was turned into an Italian opera by none other than Giacomo Puccini, who was very famous.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I believe you that he's famous. He?
Yes. Okay. Giacomo.
Giacomo's a plus size clothing brand, isn't it?
It's not spelled the same. Oh. again, that was based on the
real or the
Petit de la Croix story rather than her real life. And then more recently, Kudlun has appeared on our screens in the Netflix series Marco Polo.
Marco Polo.
Which is a super sexy watch.
Did you write that? Did you think it was super sexy?
Oh my god, Marco Polo is so fit. He's so fit.
I think I fancied one of the bad people.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember. It's been years since I watched it.
No one was particularly good.
No.
But anyway,
I remember being like, you're a bad person. And I fancy you. I can't remember.
I just fancied the pants off Marco Polo.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fancied the pants off him. She wanted to snog his face off.
Would not mind. So although it was very sexualized, it is far removed from historical truth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Genghis Khan is in it, and Kudlun is in it, even though she's his great-great-granddaughter, and they never met.
Yeah.
And then Marco Polo and Kudlun have a little affair. That never happened.
Yeah.
She's also quite small, the actress that they use, who is a very good actress. But, like, it's very much noted that Kudlun was a big gal.
Yeah.
Definitely.
If she's going to be a fucking sick warrior, she's got to have some meat on her, hasn't she?
A very common word for her was broad.
Okay.
So, I was like, well, this isn't the most representation. Like, you've definitely gone for a very pretty, slender woman. However, it's Netflix. It's going to be...
It's got to be palatable.
Yes, it's got to be super sexy.
Our eyes can't take non-sexy.
Well, she probably, I mean, that's definitely a She-Hulk kind of sexiness to Kudlun.
Okay.
Like, a woman that can definitely crush your head.
Between her thighs.
I was going to go there.
Yeah. I went there for you, so you didn't have to.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you.
That's Princess Kudlun, the wrestler princess.
No, the Princess of 10,000 Horses.
All the Warrior Princess.
The Warrior Princess.
Or the Bright Moon.
Of 10,000 Horses.
Just want to give a shout out to my sources.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of websites called Rejected Princesses.
Oh.
Oh, it's cool.
I know, but it's such a good name, but it's so sad.
Another website called Badass of the Week, which is very suitable for us. And a wonderful podcast called Stuff You Missed in History Class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
I feel like a princess.
I want to be that kind of princess.
I'm going to go and ride 10,000 horses.
Oh. All at the same time?
Yep.
Okay. Good luck.
Very little ones.
Oh, tiny horses.
Oh. Shall we listen a story?
Yeah, we shall listen a story.
Okay. So this week I am reading a story from none other than Matilda Eyre, who wrote our jingle and is brilliant and very supportive.
She is fab.
And we love her. Okay, so as ever, I'll just read the words as they are written.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother brought home a violin and gave me the choice, violin or piano. I chose the piano. My grandmother's piano, on which she had already learned to play as a child, was still in her living room. At that time, shortly after the war, She grew up with her aunts, Aunt Hedwig and Aunt Ida. Although the family had very limited opportunities and financial means, it was very important to Aunt Hedwig that one would develop their own talents and set a strong foundation. She insisted that my grandmother would learn English in the early hours before school and also learn music and study piano. Deeply rooted in a matriarchy of incredibly hard-working women, I often wonder if my great-great-aunt's decision to empower my grandmother has influenced my entire life to this day. Through several long-gone generations, no gesture seems too small. In gratitude for all the women who've come before me, I'm humbled by their strength and our interconnected resilience.
Wow. That's awesome.
That's like a double whammy listener story, because, well, however many women in there. Yeah. Three? Four? Oh. That's so great.
10,000? Yeah. More than I can count.
They won't stop moving!
Oh, thank you, Matilda.
Yeah, that was so good.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
I have another listener story.
Yep.
From Warren. So, reading it as written, as per usual. Nowadays, I'm sad to say, I don't have many inspirational women in my life, not apart from friends. Historical figures-wise, I always loved Joan of Arc. We used to go on holiday to the same place in France every summer and go round all the churches which had statues and pictures of kings and male religious figures. But there was one church that had a statue of Joan of Arc, and I think I remember it because it was the only woman. Anyway, I loved her story about her going to war and pretending to be a man and how it was so unjust that she was burnt at the stake for doing it. My fave Disney film was always Mulan, and I feel like that was why. She's my original fave historical woman icon. It's quite hard to think of ones as we were never taught a lot about them at school.
That's really interesting. That's tied in quite nicely with the statues and the forgotten women. We always do that.
And also Crudelin, who was a fighter.
Of course, but she didn't pretend to be a man.
No, she didn't.
Lovely. Thank you, Warren.
Yeah, thank you. I think it brings in a lot of valid points, is that it's not always really obvious to people.
I like that they're honest with that, because a lot of people I've asked, I think, have been too scared to tell me that they can't think of anyone.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's why we're doing it.
Exactly.
Like,
and like, whether it is a Disney character, like Mulan, who is, that's a great
film. If you can't think of any women that have inspired you, it's not your fault.
Absolutely not.
We'll help.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. Don't forget to email your listener stories to thatswhatshesaidlisteners@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. You can also find us on the social medias. Twitter, That's What She Pod. Instagram, That's What She Said_podcast. And Facebook, which is Hannah?
That's What She Said Podcast.
Great. I don't know why I always forget that one. It's the easiest one. It's the most logical. I just want to put underscores everywhere. Cool.
Yeah, well, that was good.
Our first AM recording. Yep. Recording without wine.
Oh my god. But coffee and brioche.
Oh.
We're quite
so
set.
Fancy. Yeah.
So enjoy your holidays, everyone.
Yeah, whatever you're up to. Yep. Hope you can have a little rest, little break.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back in the new year now.
Yeah.
Happy end of 2018.
Yep. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. End of Lang Syne. No, we're not going to do that. Okay.
No.
That's fine. Let's just go.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye.